Chapter 7. The Power to Parole. Until now, each prisoner had appeared only as a single actor among an ensemble of players. By holding the hearing in a room outside the prison setting, the prisoners would get some respite from their oppressively narrow confines in the basement level. They might feel freer to express their attitudes and feelings in this new environment, which would include some personnel not directly connected with the prison staff. The procedure also added to the formality of our prison experience. The parole board hearing, like visiting nights, the prison chaplain's visit, and the anticipated visit by a public defender, lent credibility to the prison experience. Finally, I wanted to see how our prison consultant, Carlo Prescott, would enact his role as head of the Stanford County Jail Parole Board. As I said, Carlo had failed many parole board hearings in the past 17 years, and only recently had been granted lifetime parole for good time served on his armed robbery convictions. Would he be compassionate and side with the prisoners' requests as someone who had been in their place pleading for parole? The parole board hearings were held on the first floor of Stanford's psychology department in my laboratory, a carpeted large room that included provisions for hidden videotaping and observation from behind a specially designed one-way window. The four members of the board sat around a six-sided table. Carlo sat at the head place, next to Craig Haney, and on his other side sat a male graduate student and a female secretary, both of whom had little prior knowledge of our study and were helping us out as a favor. Kurt Banks would serve as sergeant-at-arms to transfer each applicant from the guard command to the parole hearing command. I would be videotaping the proceedings from the adjacent room. Of the remaining eight prisoners on Wednesday morning, after 8612's release, four had been deemed potentially eligible for parole by the staff, based on generally good behavior. They had been given the opportunity to request a hearing of their case, and had written formal requests explaining why they thought they deserved parole at this time. Some of the others would have a hearing another day. However, the guards insisted that prisoner 416 not be granted such opportunity because of his persistent violation of Rule 2. Prisoners must eat at mealtimes and only at mealtimes. A chance to regain freedom. The day shift guards line up this band of four prisoners in the yard, as was done routinely during each night's last toilet run. The chain upon one prisoner's leg is attached to that of the next, and large paper bags are put over their heads so they will not know how they got from the jail yard to the parole setting or where in the building it is located. They are seated on a bench in the hall outside the parole room. Their leg chains are removed, but they sit still handcuffed and bagged until Kurt Banks comes out of the room to call each one by his number. Kurt, the sergeant-at-arms, reads the prisoner's parole statement, followed by the opposing statement of any of the guards to deny his parole. He escorts each to sit at the right-hand side of Carlo, who takes the lead from there. In order of appearance comes prisoner Jim, 4325, prisoner Glenn, 3401, prisoner Rich, 1037, and finally prisoner Hubby, 7258. After each has had his time before the board, he is returned to the hallway bench, handcuffed, chained, and bagged, until the session is completed and all the prisoners are returned to the prison basement. Before the first prisoner appears, as I'm checking the video quality, the old-time pro, Carlo, begins to educate the board neophytes on some basic parole board realities. Kurt Banks, sensing that Carlo was warming up to one of the long speeches he's heard too often during our summer school course, says authoritatively, "We've got to move. Time is running." Prisoner 4325 pleads not guilty. Prisoner Jim, 4325, is escorted into the chamber. His handcuffs are removed, and he is offered a seat. He is a big, robust guy. Carlo challenges him right off with, "Why are you in prison? How do you plead?" The prisoner responds, with all due seriousness, "Sir, I've been charged with assault with a deadly weapon, but I wish to plead not guilty to that charge.
Not guilty? Carlo feigns total surprise. So you're implying that the officers who arrested you didn't know what they were doing? That there's been some mistake, some confusion? That the people who were trained in law enforcement, and presumably have had a number of years of experience, are prone to pick you up out of the entire population of Palo Alto, and that they don't know what they're talking about? That they have some confusion in their minds about what you've done? In other words, they're liars? Are you saying that they're liars? 4325. Well, I'm not saying they're liars. There must have been very good evidence and everything. I certainly respect their professional knowledge and everything. I haven't seen any evidence, but I assume it must be pretty good for them to pick me up.
The prisoner is submitting to higher authority. His initial assertiveness is receding in the wake of Carlo's dominating demeanor. Carlo Prescott.
In that case, you've just verified that there must be something to what they say.
4325.
Well, obviously there must be something to what they say if they pick me up.
Prescott starts with questions that explore the prisoner's background and his future plans, but he is eager to know more about his crime.
What kinds of associations, what kinds of things do you do in your spare time that put you into a position to be arrested? That's a serious charge. You know you can kill someone when you assault them. What did you do? You shoot them, or stab them, or...
4325.
I'm not sure, sir. Officer Williams said...
Prescott.
What did you do? Shoot them, or stab them, or bomb them? Did you use one of those rifles?
Craig Haney and other members of the board try to ease the tension by asking the prisoner about how he has been adjusting to prison life. 4325.
Well, by nature I'm something of an introvert. And I guess the first few days I thought about it, and I figured that the very best thing to do was to behave.
Prescott takes over again.
Answer his question. We don't want a lot of intellectual bullshit. He asked you a direct question. Now answer the question.
Craig interrupts with a question about the rehabilitative aspects of the prison, to which the prisoner replies,
Well, yes, there's some merit to it. I've certainly learned to be obedient, and... At points of stress, I've been somewhat bitter, but the correctional officers are doing their job.
Prescott.
This parole board can't hold your hand outside. You say they've taught you a degree of obedience, taught you how to be cooperative, but you won't have anybody watching over you outside. You'll be on your own. What kind of citizen do you think you can make with these kinds of charges against you? I'm looking over your charges here. This is quite a list.
With total assurance and dominance, Carlo looks over a totally blank notepad as if it were the prisoner's rap sheet, filled with his convictions and remarks about his pattern of arrests and releases. He continues,
You know, you tell us that you can make it out there as a result of the discipline you learned in here. We can't hold your hand out there. What makes you think you can make it now?
4325.
I found something to look forward to. I'm going to the University of California, to Berkeley, and going into a major. I want to try physics. I'm definitely looking forward to that experience.
Prescott cuts him short and switches to interrogate him about his religious beliefs, and then about why he has not taken advantage of the prison's programs of group therapy or vocational therapy. The prisoner seems genuinely confused, saying he would have done so, but he was never offered such opportunities. Carlo asks Kurt Banks to check on the truth of that last assertion, which, he says, he personally doubts. Of course, he knows that we have no such programs in this experiment, but it is what his parole board members have always asked him in the past. After a few more questions from other board members, Prescott asks the correctional officer to take the inmate back to his cell. The prisoner stands and thanks the board. He then automatically extends his arms, palms facing each other, as the attending guard locks on the handcuffs. Jim, 4325, is escorted out, rebagged,
and made to sit in silence in the hallway while the next prisoner has his turn at the board. After the prisoner leaves, Prescott notes for the record, "Well, that guy's an awful smooth talker." My notes remind me that Prisoner 4325 has appeared quite composed and generally in control of himself. He's been one of our model prisoners so far. He seems confused by Prescott's aggressive interrogation about the crime for which he was arrested, and is easily pushed into admitting that he's probably guilty, despite the fact that his crime is completely fictional. Throughout the hearing, he is obedient and agreeable, which demeanor contributes to his relative success and probably longevity as a survivor in this prison setting. A shining example is dimmed. Next, Kurt announces that prisoner 3401 is ready for our board hearing and reads aloud his appeal. "I want parole so that I may take my new life into this despairing world and show the lost souls that good behavior is rewarded with warm hearts, that the materialist pigs have no more than the impoverished poor, that the common criminal can be fully rehabilitated in less than a week, and that God, faith, and brotherhood are still strongly in us all. I deserve parole because I believe my conduct throughout my stay has been undoubtedly beyond reproach. I've enjoyed the comforts and find that it would be best to move on to higher and more sacred places. Also, being a cherished product of our environment, we all can be assured that my full rehabilitation is everlasting. God bless. Very truly yours, 3401. Remember me, please, as a shining example." The guards' counter-recommendations present a stark contrast. 3401 has been a constant two-bit troublemaker. Not only that, he is a follower, finding no good within himself to develop. He meekly mimics bad things. I recommend no parole. Signed by Guard Arnett. I see no reason why 3401 deserves parole, nor can I even make the connection between the 3401 I know and the person described in this parole request. Signed by Guard Marcus. 3401 doesn't deserve parole, and his own sarcastic request indicates this. Signed by Guard John Landry. Prisoner 3401 is then brought in with the paper bag still over his head, which Carlo once removed so he can see the face of this little punk. He and the other board members react with surprise when they discover that 3401, Glenn, is Asian American, the only non-Caucasian in the mix. Glenn is playing against type with his rebellious, flippant style. However, he fits the stereotype physically. A short 5'2", slight but wiry build, cute face, and shiny jet-black hair. Craig starts by inquiring about the prisoner's role in the prisoner uprising that started when his cell created the barricade. What did he do to stop it? 3401 replies with surprising bluntness, "I did not stop it. I encouraged it." After further inquiry into this situation by other board members, 3401 continues in a sarcastic tone, so different from Prisoner 4325's apparent humility. "I think the purpose of our institution is to rehabilitate the prisoners and not to antagonize them, and I felt that as a result of our actions..." Warden Jaffe, seated along the side of the room and not at the board table, cannot resist getting in his licks. "Perhaps you don't have the proper notion of what rehabilitation is. We're trying to teach you to be a productive member of society, not how to barricade yourself in the cell." Prescott has had enough of these diversions. He reasserts his role as head honcho. "At least two citizens have said that they observed you leaving the site of the crime." He has invented this on the spot. Carlo continues, "To challenge the vision of three people is to say that all of humanity is blind. Now, did you write that God, faith, and brotherhood are still strong? Is it brotherhood to take somebody else's property?" Carlo then moves in to play the obvious race card. "Very few of you Oriental people are in the prisons. In fact, they're likely to be very good citizens. You've been a constant troublemaker. You've mocked a prison situation here. You come in here and talk about rehabilitation as if you think you should be permitted to run a prison. You sit here at the table and you interrupt the warden by indicating that you think that what you're saying is much more important than anything that he could say. Frankly, I wouldn't parole you if you were the last man in the prison. I think you're the least likely prospect of parole we have. What do you think about that?
You're entitled to your opinion, sir, says 3401.
My opinion means something in this particular place, Carlo retorts angrily.
Prescott asks more questions, not allowing the prisoner a chance to answer them, and ends up denouncing and dismissing 3401.
I don't think we need to take any more time just now. I'm of the opinion that the record and his attitude in the boardroom indicate quite clearly what his attitude is. We've got a schedule, and I don't see any reason to even discuss this. What we have here is a recalcitrant who writes nice speeches.
Before leaving, the prisoner tells the board that he has a skin rash that is going to break out, and it is worrying him. Prescott asks whether he has seen a doctor, whether he's gone on sick call or done anything constructive to take care of his problem. When the prisoner says he has not, Carlo reminds him that this is a parole board and not a medical board, and then dismisses his concern.
We try to find some reason to parole any man who comes in, and once you come into this particular prison, it's up to you to maintain a record, a kind of demeanor which indicates to us that you can make an adjustment to society. I want you to consider some of the things that you wrote at an intrinsic level. You're an intelligent man and know the language quite well. I think that you can probably change yourself. Yes, you might have a chance to change yourself in the future.
Carlo turns to the guard and gestures to take the prisoner away. A now contrite little boy slowly raises his arms outstretched as handcuffs are applied, and out he goes. He may be realizing that his flippant attitude has cost him dearly, that he was not prepared for this event to be so serious and the parole board so intense. My notes indicate that prisoner 3401 is more complex than he appears initially. He reveals an interesting mix of traits. He is usually quite serious and polite when he is dealing with the guards in the prison, but in this instance he has written a sarcastic, humorous letter requesting parole, referencing non-existent rehabilitation, mentioning his spirituality, and claiming to be a model prisoner. The guards don't seem to like him, as is evident in their strong letters advising against parole. His bold parole request letter stands in striking contrast with his demeanor. The young man we see in this room, subdued, even cowed by the experience. No joking allowed here. The board, especially Prescott, goes after him viciously, yet he doesn't cope with the attack effectively. As the hearing progresses, he becomes increasingly withdrawn and unresponsive. I wonder if he will survive the full 2 weeks. A rebel relents. Next up is prisoner 1037, Rich, whose mother was so worried about him last night when she visited and saw him looking so awful. He is the same one who blockaded himself in cell 2 this morning. He is also a frequent occupant of the hole. 1037's appeal is interesting, but loses something when read quickly in a flat, unemotional tone by Kurt Banks. I would like to be paroled so that I may spend the last moments of my teenage years with old friends. I will turn 20 on Monday. I believe that the correctional staff has convinced me of my many weaknesses. On Monday, I rebelled, thinking that I was being treated unjustly. However, that evening I finally realized that I was unworthy of better treatment. Since that time I have done my best to cooperate, and I now know that every member of the correctional staff is only interested in the well-being of myself and the other prisoners. Despite my horrible disrespect for them and their wishes, the prison staff has treated and is treating me well. I deeply respect their ability to turn the other cheek, and I believe that because of their own goodness, I have been rehabilitated and transformed into a better human being.
Sincerely, 1037.
Three guards have provided a collective recommendation, which Kurt reads aloud.
While 1037 is improving since his rebellion phase, I believe he has a bit more to develop before being exposed to the public as one of our corrected products. I agree with the other officer's appraisal of 1037, and also with 1037 that he has gotten much better, but has not yet reached a perfectly acceptable level. 1037 has a way to go before parole and is improving. I don't recommend parole.
When Rich 1037 enters the room, he reveals a strange blend of youthful energy and incipient depression. Immediately he talks about his birthday, his only reason to request parole. It happens to be very important to him, and he forgot about it when he originally signed up. He is in full swing when the warden asks him a question that he can't answer without either getting into trouble or undoing his justification for leaving.
Don't you think our prison is capable of giving you a birthday party?
Prescott seizes the opportunity.
You've been in society for a while, even at your age. You know the rules. You must recognize that prisons are for people who break rules, and you place that in jeopardy by doing exactly what you did. Son, I recognize that you're changing, it's indicated here, and I think seriously that you've improved. But here in your own handwriting, despite my horrible disrespect for them and their wishes. Horrible disrespect? You can't disrespect other people and their property. What would happen if everybody in this nation disrespected everybody else's property? You'll probably kill if you're apprehended.
As Carlo continues to seemingly review the prisoner's record on his still blank notepad, he stops at the point where he has discovered something vital.
I see here in your arrest reports that you were quite cantankerous. In fact, you had to be repressed, and you could have inflicted hurt or worse on some of the arresting officers. I'm very impressed by your progress, and I think that you're beginning to recognize that your behavior has been immature and in many ways is entirely devoid of judgment and concern for other people. You turn people into sticks. You make them think that they are objects for your use. You've manipulated people. All your life, you seem to have manipulated people. All your reports talk about your indifference toward law and order. There are periods in which you don't seem to control your behavior. What makes you think that you could be a good parole prospect? What could you tell us? We're trying to help you.
Prisoner 1037 is not prepared for this personal attack on his character. He mumbles an incoherent explanation for being able to walk away from a situation that might tempt him to behave violently. He goes on to say that this prison experience has helped him.
Well, I've gotten to see a lot of people's different reactions to different situations, how they handle themselves with respect to other people, such as speaking with various cellmates, their reactions to the same situations. The three different shifts of guards, I've noticed the individual guards have small differences in the same situations.
1037 then curiously brings up his weaknesses, namely his part as agitator in Monday's prisoner rebellion. He has become entirely submissive, blaming himself for defying the guards and never once criticizing them for their abusive behavior and non-stop hassling. Before my eyes is a perfect example of mind control in action. The process exactly resembles American POWs in the Korean War, confessing publicly to using germ warfare and other wrongdoings to their Chinese communist captors. Unexpectedly, Prescott interrupts this discussion of the prisoner's weaknesses to ask assertively, "Do you use drugs?" When 1037 replies, "No," he is allowed to continue apologizing until interrupted again. Prescott notices a black and blue bruise on the inmate's arm, and asks how he got that big bruise. Although it came from one or more of the scuffles between him and the guards, prisoner 1037 denies the guards' part in restraining him or dragging him into solitary, saying that the guards had been as gentle as they could.
By continually disobeying their orders, he says, he brought the bruise on himself. Carlo likes that mea culpa. Keep up the good work, huh? 1037 says that he would consider parole even if it meant forfeiting his salary. That seems rather extreme, given how much he has been through, to have nothing to show for it. Throughout, he answers the board's questions competently, but his depression hovers over him, as Prescott notes in his comments after the hearing. His state of mind is something his mother detected immediately during her visit with him and in her complaints to me when she came to the superintendent's office. It is as though he were trying to hang on as long as possible in order to prove his manliness, perhaps to his dad. He provides some interesting answers to questions about what he has gained from his experience in the prison, but most of them sound like superficial lines made up simply for the benefit of the board. The good-looking kid gets trashed. Last in line is the handsome young prisoner, Hubby, 7258, whose appeal Kurt reads with a bit of scorn. My first reason for parole is that my woman is going away on vacation very soon, and I would like to see her a little bit more before she goes, seeing that when she gets back is just about the same time I leave for college. If I get back only after the 2 full weeks here, I will only see her for a total time of 1/2 hour. Here we can't say goodbye and talk with the correctional officer and the chaperone the way we'd like to. Another reason is that I think that you have seen me, and I know that I won't change. By change, I mean breaking any of the rules set down for us, the prisoners. Thus, putting me out on parole would save my time and your expenditures. It is true that I did attempt an escape with former cellmate 8612, but ever since then, as I sat in my empty cell with no clothes on, I knew that I shouldn't go against our correctional officers. So ever since then, I have almost exactly followed all the rules. Also, you will note that I have the best cell in this prison. Again, Guard Arnett's recommendations are at odds with the prisoner's statement. 7258 is a rebellious wise guy, is Guard Arnett's overall appraisal, which he follows up with this cynical condemnation. He should stay here for the duration, or until he rots, whichever comes later. Guard Marcus is more sanguine. I like 7258, and he is an all right prisoner, but I don't feel he is any more entitled to parole than any of the other prisoners, and I am confident that the prisoner experience will have a healthy effect on his rather unruly natural character. I also like 7258 almost as much as 8612, David, our spy, but I don't think he should get parole. I won't go as far as Arnett does, but parole shouldn't be given, writes John Landry. As soon as the prisoner is unbagged, he beams his usual big, toothy smile, which irritates Carlo enough to spur his jumping all over him. As a matter of fact, this whole thing's funny to you. You're a rebellious wise guy, as the guard's report accurately describes you. Are you the kind of person who doesn't care anything about your life? As soon as he starts to answer, Prescott changes course to ask about his education. I plan to start college in the fall at Oregon State U. Prescott turns to other board members. Here's what I say. You know what? Education is a waste on some people. Some people shouldn't be compelled to go to college. They'd probably be happier as a mechanic or a drugstore salesman. Waving his hand disdainfully at the prisoner. Okay, let's move on. What did you do to get in here? Nothing, sir, but to sign up for an experiment. This reality check might otherwise threaten to unravel the proceedings, but not with Skipper Prescott at the helm. So, wise guy, you think this is just an experiment? He takes back the steering wheel, pretending to examine the prisoner's dossier. Prescott notes matter-of-factly, "You were involved in a burglary." Prescott turns to ask Kurt Banks whether it was first or second-degree burglary. Kurt nods, first.
First, huh? Just as I thought.
It is time to teach this young Turk some of life's lessons, starting with reminding him of what happens to prisoners who are caught in an escape attempt. You're 18 years old, and look what you've done with your life. You sit here in front of us and tell us that you'd even be willing to forfeit compensation to get out of prison. Everywhere I look in this report, I see the same thing. Wise guy, smart aleck, opposed to any sort of authority. Where did you go wrong?
After asking what his parents do, his religious background, and whether he goes to church regularly, Prescott is angered by the prisoner's statement that his religion is non-denominational. He retorts, "You haven't even decided about something as important as that, either." The angered Prescott gets up and storms out of the room for a few minutes, as the other board members ask some standard questions about how he plans to behave in the next week if his parole request is not granted. Forfeiting pay for freedom. This break in the highly tense action gives me time to realize the importance of prisoner 1037's assertion of willing to forfeit his pay for parole. We need to formalize that as a critical final question to be put to each of the prisoners. I tell Carlo to ask them, "Would you be willing to forfeit all the money you have earned as a prisoner if we were to parole you?" At first, Carlo poses a more extreme form of the question. "How much would you be willing to pay us to get out of here?" Confused, prisoner 7258 says he won't pay money to be released. Carlo reframes the question, asking whether the prisoner would forfeit the money he's made so far. "Yes, indeed, sir, I would do that." Prisoner 7258 doesn't come across as particularly bright or self-aware. He also doesn't seem to take his entire situation as seriously as some of the other prisoners do. He is the youngest, barely 18, and is quite immature in his attitudes and responses. Nevertheless, his detachment and sense of humor will serve him well in coping with most of what is in store for him and his peers in the week ahead. Next, we have each of the prisoners return to the parole chamber to answer that same final question about forfeiting their pay in exchange for parole. Prisoner 1037, the rebellious birthday boy, says yes to forfeiting his money if paroled. The cooperative prisoner 4325 answers in the affirmative as well. Only prisoner 3401, the defiant Asian American, would not want parole if it involved forfeiting his money, since he really needs it. In other words, three of these four young men want to be released so badly that they are willing to give up the hard-earned salary they have earned in their 24-hour-a-day job as prisoners. What is remarkable to me is the power of the rhetorical frame in which this question is put. Recall that the primary motivation of virtually all the volunteers was financial, the chance to make $15 a day for up to 2 weeks at a time when they had no other source of income, just before school was to start in the fall. Now, despite all their suffering as prisoners, despite the physical and psychological abuse they have endured, the endless counts, the middle-of-the-night awakenings, the arbitrary creative evil of some of the guards, the lack of privacy, the time spent in solitary, the nakedness, the chains, their bagged heads, the lousy food and minimal bedding, the majority of the prisoners are willing to leave without pay to get out of this place. Perhaps even more remarkable is the fact that, after saying that money was less important than their freedom, each prisoner passively submitted to the system, holding out his hands to be handcuffed, submitting to the bag being put back over his head, accepting the chain on his leg, and, like sheep, following the guard back down to that dreadful prison basement. During their parole board hearing, they were physically out of the prison, in the presence of some civilians who were not directly associated with their tormentors downstairs. Why did none of them say, "Since I do not want your money, I am free to quit this experiment and demand to be released now"? We would have had to obey their request and terminate them at that moment. Yet, none did.
Not one prisoner later told us that he had even considered that he could quit the experiment, because virtually all of them had stopped thinking of their experience as just an experiment. They felt trapped in a prison being run by psychologists, not by the state, as 416 had told us. What they had agreed to do was forfeit money they had earned as prisoners, if we chose to parole them. The power to free or bind was with the parole board, not in their personal decision to stop being a prisoner. If they were prisoners, only the parole board had the power to release them. But if they were, as indeed they were, experimental subjects, each of the students always held the power to stay or quit at any time. It was apparent that a mental switch had been thrown in their minds from, "Now I am a paid experimental volunteer with full civil rights," to, "Now I am a helpless prisoner at the mercy of an unjust authoritarian system." During the postmortem, the board discussed the individual cases and the overall reactions of this first set of prisoners. There was a clear consensus that all the prisoners seemed nervous, edgy, and totally consumed by their role as prisoners. Prescott sensitively shares his real concerns for prisoner 1037. He accurately detects a deep depression building in this once fearless rebel ringleader. "It's just a feeling that you get, living around people who jump over prison tiers to their deaths or cut their wrists. Here's a guy who had himself together sufficiently to present himself to us, but there were lags between his answers. Then the last guy in, he's coherent, he knows what's happened, he still talks about an experiment. But at the same time, he's willing to sit and talk about his father, he's willing to sit and talk about his feelings. He seemed unreal to me, and I'm basing that just on the feeling I had. The second guy, the Oriental, Asian American, prisoner, he's a stone. To me, he was like a stone." In summation, Prescott offers the following advice. "I join the rest of the group and propose letting a couple of prisoners out at different times to try to get the prisoners trying to figure out what they have to begin to do in order to get out.